Welcome to the Side Hustle Project, a podcast where we explore the nitty-gritty details behind what it takes to start and grow a profitable side hustle. I'm your host, Ryan Robinson, and in this podcast, I'm bringing you interviews with entrepreneurs, best-selling authors, CEOs, investors, and people just like you who are building and profiting from interesting side hustles. In today's episode, we're talking to Pam Slim, the popular blogger, career coach, and author of two highly regarded business books, Escape from Cubicle Nation and Body of Work. Originally from California, Pam built a powerful personal brand for herself in the 1990s and early 2000s as a consultant in the corporate leadership training and development industry. She scored big-name clients like HP, Cisco, Charles Schwab, Chevron, and Office Depot, to name a few, during her 10-year career as a training consultant. It wasn't until the year 2005, while Pam was taking a class about growing your personal brand, that she decided to start working on her own blog. And that's when Escape from Cubicle Nation was born. From here, she began building relationships with fellow bloggers that covered similar topics related to quitting your day job and growing a small business. And on one fateful day, Guy Kawasaki featured her story to his massive readership, and Pam's blog started growing by leaps and bounds. Shortly thereafter, her own community of readers began to increase, and she started working on her very first book, Escape from Cubicle Nation. In this episode, Pam and I talk about how she quit her own corporate day job and launched immediately into landing her first consulting gig with a not-so-little company, Hewlett-Packard. We discuss the intricacies of what it takes to create a well-rounded life while still carving out the time from your busy schedule to grow a profitable side business and take meaningful strides towards self-employment. We dive deep into getting more blog readers, how to promote your work, why Pam decided to launch a small business accelerator in Arizona, and seriously, so much more. As always, you can find everything we mention in today's episode in the show notes at ryrob.com/podcast. That's spelled ryrob.com/podcast. Let's get into today's interview with Pam Slim. Pam, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm excited to have you here. You are someone that I've been following online for pretty much as long as I can remember. Your book, Escape from Cubicle Nation, came out right as I was starting my own journey into the workforce. And it was definitely something that was influential in pushing me towards side businesses, but in the very early days. And before I get all gushy on you here, let's rewind the clock a little bit. I want to talk about your early days. Where are you originally from?
I am from San Anselmo, California, which is the city where Star Wars was made. Most people do not realize. So we actually have a statue of Yoda at City Hall, where my dad was mayor. Yeah.
Did you say your dad was mayor?
He was in 1971.
Oh, wow.
Probably decades before you were even born.
What did your parents do when you were growing up?
My dad was a photographer, and he actually was an industrial photographer, so he worked for Pacific Gas and Electric. And my mom was a stay-at-home mom. My parents split when I was about five, so then she taught special ed, and then she worked for hospice. So she's always been really on the service side, taking care of people, and my dad has kind of been on the creative side.
Wow. Fascinating. Do you remember the very first kind of side project or even, you know, business of your own that you started working on?
What's funny is I never have had really a side business. I had a side nonprofit organization. So in all the years when I was working full-time in training and development in San Francisco, I was volunteer executive director for Omalu Capoeira Group, which is an Afro-Brazilian martial art group. And so for about 11 years, I didn't even know, didn't call it a side hustle then, but that's essentially what it was. I'd work all day and then I'd change my clothes and jump down and teach capoeira classes. And then the weekends I would, you know, post flyers and do performances and a whole bunch of stuff.
Uh-huh. Sounds like a side project to me.
That's right. Just not for money, for love.
Which is also okay and highly encouraged.
Yeah, it's true. I think there's, I will love to really dig in and split some hairs around it, because I think not everything has to be monetized for sure.
Yeah, I agree a lot. I think you get a lot of different benefits too by things that you learn or experiences that you have or people that you meet in those, like, call them extracurriculars, I guess, outside of just work.
Yeah. And it was funny, when I did go on my own in 1996, I, at that point, had no intention whatsoever of working for myself because I had never had training or experience. And it wasn't until after I quit and I just started to do some consulting that I realized that 11 years of running a nonprofit was actually entrepreneurial experience. Mm-hmm. And I know it sounds so self-evident, but it wasn't to me. And that was a really good lesson of, I learned so much in doing that that really helped me on my self-employed journey.
I can imagine. And I want to talk about your self-employed journey back when you kind of first started, because, you know, doing my homework before we started this interview here, it looks like you, you know, out of university had some jobs that were kind of in corporate training and development, leadership development, things like that. And you eventually go out and do that on your own afterwards, right?
Yeah. So I had a whole winding path, probably hitting about every work mode possible. My degree was in community development and non-formal education in Latin America. So I kind of set out to be doing community development, but I just realized once I got into it, living in South America, that I was like, what the hell was a 19-year-old American doing trying to make change in a country where they were very capable themselves, you know? And so I then began on the path of going into nonprofit and then eventually into corporate training and development, which I loved. I loved my cubicle. Even though I wrote Escape from Cubicle Nation, I actually had a great time in corporate, really enjoyed it, and ended up at Barclays Global Investors, which was my last real job that I had. But the first 10 years of my business after I quit in 1996, I spent working on the human side of business, doing executive coaching and change management and all kinds of interesting things. It was just fascinating. Like, I've always had a great love that has continued to present day for training and development.
Yeah, that's a special gift, because that's not something that everyone is, you know, first of all, talented at, and then second of all, going to enjoy doing.
Yeah, well, it's so essential. It's really interesting, because I did training when I was at Barclays, at UC Berkeley, in a certificate program for training and development. And it's funny, it's very meta, because the training that I did there, I still refer to just about every day in work that I do with clients and programs that I've designed. It's like, with such great training about training. And to me, sometimes it's an example of when we do codify our experience and we create really useful frameworks and tools, they can apply in so many different areas. And it's why I always encourage my clients to not just have thoughts in your head, especially if you're a service professional, but write it down, create frameworks, you know, really codify your IP, because it can be so valuable.
I agree. So your time, your first 10 years, as you put it, when you're running your own business, consulting, doing the training and development stuff, some of the clients you work with, HP, Cisco, Charles Schwab, Chevron, Office Depot, really, really big names. Did you sort of instantly land these kind of big name clients once you went on out on your own, or did you work your way up to this level?
Yeah, I was really lucky in that I started out, HP was my very first client. And wow. At the time, they were very, very well regarded and was kind of a gold standard within, you know, Silicon Valley. And I think it was really, given the time of what was happening in Silicon Valley then, it was amazing. Like, you know, people would peel off and go to another company. So I worked for 3Com and then for Cisco. And it just tended to be something where, as happens sometimes in like branded areas, you know, where, meaning that when people know that you've worked for a certain company, it's really easy for them to trust you to be doing work in another. And so it was very helpful to me to start out there. And then, you know, I worked in all kinds of different companies within the 10 years that I did that kind of consulting. But I think it's really helpful to be thinking about, what are some of the characteristics of organizations that you love? And for me, it was always people doing really cutting edge work in interesting ways. I love tech. I mean, it was very intoxicating and an interesting time to be doing that work.
Mm-hmm. So thinking about, you know, our listeners here today that are freelancers, consultants, if you had to look back at, you know, anything aside from just solely that like word of mouth echo chamber of kind of like making yourself known within a niche, which I think there's a lot to be said for that. That's super powerful. But if you had to point towards anything else, are there any other sort of common themes between how you landed some of these big name clients that you would like look back at and say, hey, that was a really useful, impactful way to get on the radar of some of these big companies? Does anything else come to mind?
You have to be really good at what you do. And I think this is something that we don't often take into consideration. It's a definite paradox, because one of the ways that you do gain skills and knowledge is by doing the work. And I know when I started, especially when I started the entrepreneurial work, I really didn't have tons of experience besides just starting a business myself. But there's a certain perspective, I think, that you have about the work, to really be passionate about it, to look at it as a craft, to want to get better. And I do get crabby, admittedly, when the only conversation is about, you know, how many conversions you had and, you know, how many people in an audience you closed, because I'm sitting back there screaming silently, like, usually it's backstage, right? Whereas people who are speaking, getting excited just about who they close, as opposed to, are you actually going to help them? Is what you're doing really effective, and is it working? And I think that's a lot of what my training and development background has taught me, is to really look at performance improvement and to understand the science of what it really takes to help somebody change. Like, it's hard. And so it's okay where you're starting out in the journey and you have a lot to learn, but you do want to be really, really tenaciously focused on solving the problems of your clients and customers and loving them and leaning into the problems and not just getting carried away with the money to be made from them, because they're humans, right? And to have a long-term, really good reputation, you have to do good work.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, as you put it, really, like, those are the, you get a lot of personal benefit out of that aside from just the money, right? Like, you're learning things yourself. You're finessing your own process. You're learning how to better help similar types of people, types of companies. I think there's a lot to be said for just beyond the financial gain from that.
Yeah, it's really important. And it's interesting because it does interface very clearly with branding. I've learned kind of the opposite lesson too, of if you're just focused on putting your head down and doing great work and not necessarily sharing that with people, they may not really know what you do. And I had a really funny experience, funny in retrospect, at South by Southwest a number of years ago with somebody who was a friend from a local area in Phoenix where, you know, I'd recently moved here. And we were in the bloggers lounge, which I was, you know, where I was hanging out. And he was like, you know, I'm just kind of curious, like, don't you feel bad just being like the infomercial people who's like teaching other people how to make infomercials? And I was like, what? And I realized through having conversation with him, I was like, have you actually ever read my book, or do you know really about the work that I do? And I think his assumption was that I just taught people how to quit their job to start a business and then teach them how to coach others to quit their job to start a business, which is not what I do. And it was funny because at that particular South by Southwest, I had two clients that were launching new products like in the trade show. So it was really great because I could share that with him. But because we were friends, like, it was actually a really good lesson for me. I was like, holy crap, this is somebody who I sort of know, who basically thinks I'm just a huckster and has no idea of what I've actually done with clients. So I need to take responsibility for sharing my story as well.
That's a really interesting lesson to learn. I think it's something also that you have to go out of your way to share that stuff, because you might not be thinking about it yourself, right? And it takes those like kind of friendly nudges from friends, from family, from coworkers, from clients even, to really like share success stories, things like that. And I found also, at least personally, that when I go out and do like a case study about a previous client, or, you know, share a testimonial video or an interview with a client that, you know, talks through the results that a particular campaign drove for them, I find that those actually bring more business too. It's a nice cycle.
It really is. And I think within the biggest context, if you start to look to me at things we've talked about earlier, really what's important, love of craft, love of your clients, really wanting to celebrate them, that in that context, it is such a joyful thing that also can help your business. So similar to you, like I have in my newsletter, I usually share like awesome client projects and just feature amazing things that my clients are doing because they're amazing and like do super cool things. And I get so excited to share them with people who are in my audience, but then also it's a signal to others of these are the kinds of people that I work with and these are the kinds of things that they're doing. That's a great way to be getting new clients. So I think it's in the biggest context. I know within the Escape from Cubicle Nation days when I did specifically the early stage startup coaching with people who were like still in corporate jobs doing a side hustle, that getting promotion was really important because they hadn't necessarily built an audience yet when they were doing the early stage side hustle. So that was something I learned that was also important for me to be utilizing my platform in order to be sharing their message.
I love that. Okay, so I'm going to jump around a little bit on you here now. I want to go to the year 2005, back when you first started the Escape from Cubicle Nation blog. At the time, blogging, I know, really was not as popular as it is today. So why did you decide that a blog was going to be this, you know, vehicle you were going to go for with starting your new kind of business?
I took a class called Get Known Now from a woman called Suzanne Falter. And that was an assignment in the class. Like, she was a genius. Once again, we come back to training and development because like somehow I ran across her when I was learning about starting a business. And she had a 6-month class that was very specifically focused on how you really define your niche and come up with a name and begin to generate content online. And so creating a blog was one of the assignments. And that's when I did lots of research before I came up with a name, Escape from Cubicle Nation. And then I started blogging with the intention of doing more entrepreneurial coaching. And it was just the best investment I have ever made. I've told her so many times, like, thank God she took the time to put together that class and teach it, because I think my life would look so different if I had never been aware of that.
Yeah, you're a great success story for her, that's for sure.
Well, right. I mean, what goes around comes around, right? It just was the right, perfect content and at the right time for me.
Do you remember how early readers were finding your blog back in those like very early days?
It was like my dad, my sister, my best friend, you know, at first, and then like a random person from Google. I mean, it really is the amazing thing to me still to this day of the internet, you know, how many different seeds can be planted in so many different ways. And there's definitely now it's a concept I'm working on from my new book about ecosystem marketing, which is watering holes, where one of the things I kind of learned early on is in connecting with people like Guy Kawasaki, who had a very, very rich, amazing watering hole of people who loved social change and entrepreneurship and Macintosh and like all the things that I love. And so when he featured my work on his blog, it was very much a one-to-many kind of thing. You know, and for me, that was like, it was like in May of 2006. So that was maybe 6 months or something into blogging. But it was a little bit of a different world then. We had like blog links. So you would find really cool people and link to them on their blog. And I think all of us were in the back end, like really paying attention to who was connecting with us. It was just very collegial and warm. So I think pretty quickly, there were a lot of people that kind of found me because I was putting links to their blogs on mine. And then, you know, we would share information and embed links and posts and stuff we continue to this day as a way to really get known.
I love that. I mean, if listening to you talking about this, it's really just community building, finding your community of people who are already out there and sort of weaving the webs together and building a group of people that share the same interests.
That's what it is, you know, and it's funny sometimes that you don't really see your own pattern or your own thread, as I wrote like in my own book, Body of Work, but it was like even after writing that book and looking at threads, I didn't really realize how much community building was an essential part of what it is that I did. And when I look back at what I did in my volunteer work for Capoeira, it was all about community building. We connected with like 27 different youth service organizations. And then when I got online, same thing. And then, you know, a couple of years ago when I opened up the small business incubator in my hometown of Mesa, Arizona, same thing. You know, so those patterns are ones that really work virtually and also in person.
Absolutely. So was writing your book, Escape from Cubicle Nation, was that the natural next step after seeing your blog kind of get some early traction? Or was that like a very concerted effort that you had to kind of like force yourself down the path towards?
Well, I had, after the post that Guy posted on his blog that went really, really viral, called An Open Letter to CEOs Across the Corporate World, I had had a lot of people reach out, which was amazing. And so we did an early stage, like floating of a proposal. I hadn't really thought about it. There was one of my clients, Pete, that was actually here local, and we would meet in person because he really liked to meet in person. And he would actually print out my blog posts and highlight them and bring them with them. And I remember one day he was like, can you just write a book? Because it would be so much easier. And so, you know, I sort of thought about it, but we floated the early proposal and it went nowhere. And, you know, one publisher was like, this just sounds very pedestrian. It's just like not an interesting idea. So then I just said, screw it. And I spent the next 18 months or so just going back to blogging, which I loved. And then I got an email from an editor at Portfolio. And she said, actually, she'd been listening to my podcast because I had a podcast starting way back when in 2006. And she said, I love it and love your voice and your blog. Would you consider doing a book with us? And I was super excited because that was Seth Godin's publisher and Guy Kawasaki and kind of my ideal publisher. It was also the publisher that had said that my book proposal was very pedestrian the first time around. So sometimes you got to like hone your craft and spend some time. And I ended up doing that book with them and then doing body of work with them. And it was really the right time because I felt like not only did I have more writing underneath me, but I also had a lot more client experience underneath me. So it made writing the book a lot easier.
That makes a lot of sense. What would be your number one piece of advice to our listeners here today that already have a side thing going, but they're struggling to get to the next level in a way that can kind of replace their full-time income? What should they be thinking about? How do you push through that barrier?
Well, I think the main things in the side hustle are getting extremely rigorous about how it is that you're spending your time. And I say this knowing that probably many listeners are already very rigorous, right? Like in order to not get totally burnt out, you have to really look at how you're spending your time, how you're really getting your day job done extremely well so that you don't have to worry about that. But really just slash and burn anything that is not directly related to things that you have to do. You know, get off your homeowners association, you know, committee meetings and sometimes you have to make some harder choices to really carve out the time in order to build the business to the next stage. And to me, patterns that I saw a lot when I was doing a lot of that coaching is that people can get stuck very much in conceptual land. So there's a lot of focus on building the perfect brand or spending tons of time building up a complex product. And I always just say, as soon as possible, get it out, get the prototype out, begin to work with clients. Like you have to cross that bridge of people who are not related to you, who give you money for a product or service so that you can really make sure that what you have has some viability. And then once you start to see it take root, it's a very personal choice of how it is that you want to do that path. I have a huge tolerance for risk personally. So I quit with no savings, no plan, didn't even know I was going to work for myself, right? Completely just jumped off. And that was fine. Like I have a huge tolerance for risk and it worked out. And within probably the first month, I was making more than I made as a full-time employee. That is not at all what normally happens, nor what for some people is wise advice. So also chalking away money, cutting down expenses, making sure that you have a lot saved is a really important thing for some people. And, you know, at a certain point, you're just going to find that you don't have the time, energy, and resources to be doing the side hustle for an extended period of time because it really does burn you out. So sometimes I see people take test runs where they might take some vacation time to like really go all in and try to build their business that way. Or they can take the risk of having some money saved where they go full time. Don't burn bridges. I'm never a fan of grabbing the fish like in Jerry Maguire and making a big speech and making sure that you could never go back to your day job because you never know. You know, I have seen things go every direction you can possibly imagine. And often it was not because the idea wasn't great. not because the person wasn't amazing and hardworking, just sometimes it's not the right time or not the right fit.
I think that, the concept of slashing and burning all your extracurriculars that aren't related to, achieving this very specific goal is also super important. I jotted that one down. That's going to be a post-it note for me.
That's right. I mean, feed your kids, love up on your spouse. I'm not saying, keep active, but really there are often things that we're doing that we probably don't even really want to be doing anyway, that you can put a pause on. And it's really about focus and priority, because you have to get that clear sense of what more does this business need in order to scale. And sometimes you just need more time to do the marketing and close some sales to feel confident.
All right. Well, I want to switch gears on you a little bit here again. I want to talk about one of your latest projects, Main Street Learning Hub, which is a small business incubator in your hometown, Mesa, Arizona. On the surface, this, before we start our conversation, at least, seemed very different than most of your work leading up to this point. So I'm curious to hear, what was your motivation for launching this incubator in a, physical location?
Yeah, I know, right? It seems like it wasn't related, but now you see with some of the threads that it was. Yeah, and to me, the origin of the idea came when in 2015, I did a 23-city tour teaching a community building model. And really what it was, I called it the Unbook Tour, with a wink to my friend Scott Stratton from Unmarketing, where I was really doing the book tour before writing the book, because I've always had this focus on, collaboration and community and ecosystems. It's kind of the anti-empire perspective. I think it's kind of ironic that we teach a lot about empire building. When you look at what happened in empires, and yeah, a few people got really rich and had power, but a bunch of other people really had it bad. And so that's often the model that we look at, right? That one singular person is the one who is actually creating all their success. And so I wanted to share ideas and really get it in front of people and see what resonated before I began to write the book. And so in doing that, in going to so many cities across the country, I got super inspired by seeing what people were doing on a local level. And I had been focusing so much energy in my virtual world for so long, which I really loved. And I've met many, many people in person from virtual connections. But in particular, there was one question that I asked, and it just happened to be in the very first tour stop in Berkeley, California. And I said, how many of you have ever seen a Native American presenter at a business conference that was presenting as a business expert at a conference? So I asked this question in all 23 cities, because my husband is Navajo, so our kids are Navajo and Anglo. And I asked the question in all 23 cities, and only 7 people had ever seen one. And 4 of those were in Vancouver, Canada. So on a very personal level, I was like, first of all, there are tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Native American entrepreneurs, because I know many of them. My husband had been one. And so I was thinking, what is happening where there is no visibility? And what then are we doing as parents to make sure that our kids are seeing examples of folks who come from a similar background, who look like them, who are in positions of leadership and expert status? And so that was part of really the thinking that made us want to do it here and really get more actively involved in Mesa, to just make sure that the community who is here, who is amazing and has rich experience, is really represented in the leadership. And I don't think my husband and I had any idea how amazing it would be and how profoundly moving the experience has been. And it's really helped inform, I think, so much. For me, it's kind of coming home from all the love that I had when I was in San Francisco, like literally walking the streets, right? Talking to youth. At that point, we did a lot of recruitment of youth who were in difficult situations or in gangs and things like that. And I just love knowing people on the street and getting to know folks and being helpful. And it really has informed, I think, all of my work. Certainly the ideas for the book, and looking at what's happening all across the country as we really rejuvenate and revitalize our small business. Little couple fun facts for you that I learned from the Small Business Administration study is that 99.7% of all new jobs come from small business. And 53% of the non-farm GDP is made up in small business. So, and by small, we're kind of using the SBA standards of up to $10 million and 500 employees. So it's not like sitting in your kitchen, you know,
right,
being a consultant. But that is very significant. And when we look at the level of uncertainty in the world and where our community is at risk for economic uncertainty, I think we can do a lot of really strengthening the ties locally. And then really all the learning I've done virtually with all the, you know, hundreds of thousands of people around the world, like there's a lot we can also do to share all the things that I've learned in the virtual world and apply it locally.
Yeah. I love where this is coming from too. And, you know, to kind of like weave a nice little web around this entire conversation, really, like it's your efforts outside of just the, you know, how can I make money from this specific thing? It's the efforts outside of that that have kind of come back full circle and also provided you with insights to go on and, you know, do these other things. Like you're, you know, you mentioned you have an upcoming book. What is that about? When should we expect it?
I am just finishing the proposal. So it's been like the longest ever proposal in the making, but in a good way. Like actually we really wanted to take some time in order to, you know, we did research studies. I did the 23 city tour. We have the whole experience where I absolutely use the ecosystem model to build our community here to great success. And so hopefully crossing our fingers right now, we're in the beginning of March in 2019. So we should be done by the end of this month. Everybody should tell, you know, publishers that it's a great book, even though you haven't read it, so they can buy it. And then if all goes well, I'll start writing it this year. So probably it'll come out, you know, spring 2020, something like that. I found I usually have 5 years between books. I don't really plan it that way, but that's usually what happens.
Well, they are a lot of work.
Yes, they are. Oh my gosh. But I'm excited. I'm ready. Like I really, really, really feel ready for this book. And really what the focus is, as I said, it's really looking at how we can be, you know, really casting a wider net, thinking more about a broader ecosystem for how we see the connection we have with each other. And when we look at somebody like a small business owner, right? Here, you do work helping them with their side hustle. I do work on that. We know they need a lawyer. They need a banker, an insurance agent. They need people with marketing expertise. Like they already are going everywhere within their ecosystem to meet all their needs. So to me, it makes so much more sense that you and I know each other, right? That we collectively support these small business owners that we're so passionate about helping. And in doing so, it's much easier for us to figure out how to do joint ventures and what sponsors to go to and which events would be best for us to be, you know, sponsoring or speaking at. To me, it's just a much more strategic way to evaluate the one-to-many opportunities where we can find these watering holes where many of our ideal clients are meeting, including, you know, looking at like what apps people use. I love hanging out with Small Business Web, the Cloud Software Association, you know, the people who make all the apps that serve small business owners. All of their customers are small business owners. So of course it makes sense that we're going to spend time, you know, speaking at their conferences and collaborating and creating content for them. And to me, it's just a much more accurate representation of actually what we need to do rather than the, you know, become the all-knowing expert, eye everybody else suspiciously, right? Like never be on anybody's podcast because they might like, you know, you might steal their clients or they might steal yours. Like, come on now. But it always comes out in the wash, right? If anybody's really not acting in an ethical way, it comes out and it doesn't feel good, right? So even if they're really successful and making lots of money, because I've seen so much in 25 years of being a coach, I guarantee you that they're probably not feeling very good as a human. So, you know, do you hang out with people who are really doing good work? And I think it's going to be the most beneficial for our community if we look at it that way.
I think that that's phenomenal advice. And, you know, to kind of tie it into something in my world that I was just thinking about earlier today, you know, some of my best digital friends are people that I guess are technically, you know, air quotes right now, competitors for a lot of the same, you know, keyword search terms that we both blog about. But it's that they're also out there creating amazing, high quality work and sharing it with the world. You know, they're doing a very unselfish thing in the way that I'm trying to do it as well. And it's like, you know what? I don't want to view myself as a competitor with someone like this because it's such a cool long-term opportunity to build a relationship that can last for years as well.
It's really true. And I think what it does do, we each do need to know where we fit in the ecosystem and what our own unique skills are, right? I'm positive that there are certain things you do that are much better than I could ever do, you know, based on your own experience and your background, and vice versa. And so it does force us to really get super clear where we do have friends. I'm the very same way. Some of my dearest friends would be, you know, on paper are direct competitors, but we really get to know each other and know our skills. And I don't mind. I'm like, man, if somebody goes over and they work with Jonathan Fields or Charlie Gilkey, you know, they're in good hands. I know they will take care of them very well. And I know the people who they might refer to me or choose to work with me are going to be in good hands as well.
I love it. All right. Well, Pam, I've got one final question for you. You alluded to this one a little bit earlier in our episode here, but what would you say, aside from your blog, has been the best investment you've ever made in the context of growing your business, growing your brand over the years?
Oh man, that's not an easy one because I'm really a cheapskate when it comes to it. Okay, I know. I think it's investing in going to events. So like going for a few years to South by Southwest early on paid off in so many ways. And I got new clients and exposure, and going to certain events for sure was one thing that was a really great investment.
I love that. I second it. All right. Well, Pam, thank you for joining us. Can you tell everyone listening where they can go to learn more about you and everything that you're up to?
Absolutely. You can find me at PamelaSlim.com. And if you're ever in the Arizona kind of Phoenix area, our Facebook page is the best way to find out what we're doing here at the Learning Lab. And it's just Facebook.com/KEIN Mesa, M-E-S-A, Cat in Mesa.
Beautiful. Pam, thank you again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
If you enjoyed this episode of The Side Hustle Project, I would love your support. Head on over to the Apple Podcasts app and give us a rating. And as always, you can catch every episode of The Side Hustle Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for tuning in.